if I can now start this final session of the day. Again, we've got three speakers, and this session is really looking towards the future, which is actually why we haven't got anyone from the DWP on the panel, because we wanted them not to necessarily have to stick to official government policy, but really to sort of think about how the future for online social security could go. So again, we're going to work through our presenters and then hopefully a nice bit of time for discussion at the end. So we'll start straight away with Mark O'Neill, who's the head of Skunk Works and the CIO for CLG and DCMS. Very good.
Okay, thanks very much. Yes, for my own sanity, the good news is that I cease to be CIO for DCLG and DCMS at the end of the week. So I go back to having the luxury of just having one full-time job, which will be nice. What I propose to do is to give people a very short overview of what the Skunk Works is about and how then we see that leading into the future of online service delivery, social security and otherwise. So the Skunk Works, why? Well, the Skunk Works is intended to be a response to some environmental challenges which we face in government IT. The first of those challenges is that the projects which we tend to deliver at the moment tend to be very, very big. They tend to take a very, very long time, they tend to be very, very expensive, and they tend to deliver no real benefit or value until they complete. Another challenge which we face is that on some very, 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 very rare occasions, the systems we deliver might, when I say might, just be considered slightly less than optimal. I know. I'm as shocked as you are that anyone would possibly accuse any of our systems of being that. The other problem which we have is that we have kind of conditioned the market in such a way that the market has become almost a mirror image of us. It has become large, it has become bureaucratic, it has become slow-moving, it has become not really much of a market at all, to be honest. So the Skunk Works is an attempt to tackle some of those environmental issues and think about how we might do things a bit differently. So part of the Skunk Works approach is around agile delivery. Now, what I would say about agile delivery is that agile is a word which has become somewhat of a cult word at the moment. And although it shares a number of letters with the word magic, it is not in fact magic. Though some people do seem to think you can just go izzy wizzy, let's get agile, and IT success follows rapidly. But one of the critical points about agile is that it's not just about the IT system. Unless it's a business transformation, it won't work. If you take something as complex as universal credits, there's no way that universal credits can be delivered as an agile project if the only agility is in the IT delivery. So that's why one of the core components of the DWP work is to actually look at agile organisational change as well as organisational delivery. The problem is that kind of engagement, that willingness to look at your own business model, is not necessarily something which every other part of the public sector is able to do. Skunk Works is also about tackling the issue of the big projects. The way I look at it is there's kind of almost like a continuum of projects, and that continuum tends to be driven by risk, scale. So at one end we have really big projects, really complex projects, okay, some of which are almost like black boxes. The tax system is a classic example of that. As we move down the complexity scale, down the risk scale, that's the place where we start asking difficult questions Why can't we take a different approach? Why can't we use agility? Why can't we open up our systems in a controlled way through open standards, open APIs, open data to create a kind of ecosystem in that space? Another thing which we're looking at the Skunk Works is looking at tackling, for me, what are quite baffling gaps or barriers between various communities. So there seems to be, in the public sector at least, in many places, a rather strange gap between people who do service design and the people who do service delivery. There's also a slightly strange, to me, gap anyway, between the IT community and the digital delivery community. One is seen as websites, one is seen as proper computing. There was I was talking at an Institute for Government event recently, and there was a presentation by someone from an organisation which at least one person in this room is very familiar with. Name begins with a K. And they were talking about how the government ICT strategy had been influenced, almost tainted, in the way he described it, by the influence of the digerati. Now, this strikes me as kind of weird. So one of the things which we're looking to do with Skunk Works is to come back to some very basic questions, some very simple questions. And we actually have the Skunk Works Challenge. I always feel slightly embarrassed when I tell people what this is. But at the Skunk Works, we actually have, as part of the Cabinet Office review process of all new government IT projects, we have the right to challenge them. And our challenge consists, initially anyway, of two questions. Okay? Question one, what is it that you want to do? Question two, why do you want to do it this way? Okay? Now, what we're finding, actually, is that asking those questions actually allows you to unpick quite a lot of material, quite a lot of issues, follow on from that. If we think about the future of online service delivery around social security, we're faced with a really, really big challenge. Now, my view, and it's just my view, I'm not speaking ex cathedra, on behalf of government. But my view is that what we should be looking to do is we should be looking at how we can build a platform or a set of open platforms which facilitate the delivery of services by those people who are best placed to deliver those services and those people who can create the most interesting and exciting opportunities around those services. People who are actually embedded in communities, people who actually work with communities, people who actually build on those relations. Now that is a very challenging model for a world where at the moment our standard approach is very, very locked down and very, very closed. So I think for me, the fundamental question about what does the design of online social security for the future look like, I would say what we're talking about is a set of open APIs, an open security model, open data models, and open commissioning and engagement models. The technology, the platform, the machine, the box, the language, the techniques we use to create it, I think are kind of almost second order kind of questions. For me, the first set of questions is, are we building something which is a system? Are we building something which is a service? Or are we building something which is a platform? Or are we building something which actually has attributes of all of those things? And so that, for me, is, if you like, question number one from the Skunk Works Challenge. Do I have an answer to it? No, I don't. But, as I say, wearing my Skunk Works hat... And no, I do not have a Skunk Works hat. That's a metaphorical hat. I say that because someone did actually previously ask me was I going to wear the skunk hat? But wearing my Skunkworks hat, I think what for me is really interesting about this is that with universal credits, we've got an opportunity here to not just build a replacement Social Security model, not just build a replacement online service, but actually build a whole new, much more flexible, much more engaged way of providing a service to a community which we're here to support.
Hear from Jerry Fishenden, who, as he said, has various affiliations, but we'll say Centre for Technology Policy Research because that's on your slides.
So. Okay, great. Thanks, Jane. Rather bizarrely, before talking about the future, I'm going to step back into the past, which is something I like doing, largely because otherwise I seem to spend a lot of time watching people repeat the mistakes of the past and think they're having brave new ideas when actually what they're doing is repeating ideas from some time ago. So back to 1996 and some words that sound eerily familiar in the current day. This was actually set out by Michael Heseltine in a previous Conservative government. The ambition of using IT to provide better and more efficient services to business and citizens, to improve the efficiency and openness of government, and to secure substantial cost savings for the taxpayer. All very laudable. By 2001, there were a lot of exciting initiatives being funded by the European Union and UK government, including things like Avanti, which looked at tackling the much spoken about digital divide, and that was through the PC, mobile phones, kiosks, which were a big thing at the time. I think job centres still like to think they're a wonderful innovation, and digital TV. And I can remember in the late 90s seeing digital TV services demonstrated where you'd sit in the front of them, click on red buttons and get taken to all sorts of government content, confirm things about yourself. And then by 2005, local authorities were trying to do what the Labour government encouraged them, which was to move services to the edge, to join up services from the outside in, and people like Rotherham put into place wonderful integrated systems. You'd put your information in once, so your address once, your circumstances once, and then it would not only tell you about housing benefit, but it would tell you about 60 other state benefits and enable you to submit a single application for everything you're entitled to. So the aspiration's been there 15 years, the technology's been there probably 12 years. So what are the blockers? Well, I sat in meetings around that time with senior civil servants who got positively agitated and red-faced at the idea that anyone else should possibly deliver their services and take control of them. And particularly disparaging about the ability of local councils to take on delivery of those services. So despite it being a very clear political statement that that's what they wanted to do, and despite a lot of money going into building those systems, most of them were deliberately kicked into the long grass. So if we roll forward to 2008, and poaching slides from Patrick at the back there, how well has DWP done with customer contacts online? Well, out of 145 million contacts, 340,000 were actually conducted online. And there may be good reasons for that, or there may not. Actually, over 50% of DWP's client base were online with broadband by that year, and therefore could have been using online services had they been available. There's another great statistic from one of Patrick's slide decks of it taking each DWP civil servant an average of 4 months to send one email to a customer. And I do get a bit irritated with the digital divide argument, which has come up several times today. I don't see the current bureaucratic processes as being particularly friendly to many of those people actually claiming social services. IT actually offers the ability to streamline a lot of those ineptly designed services and simplify them for people, whether that's people with access to technology themselves or whether it's people working in Job Centre Plus or Citizens Advice Bureaus acting on behalf of those people trying to make claims. The right-hand side of the slide is from 1998, a parliamentary Office of Science and Technology note, which gives a flavour from the types of things that were then current 13 years ago. So geodata projects bringing together information from six different departments and agencies, benefits information available in kiosks and rural post offices and the like. You know, it'd be quite easy to change the dates on most of these references from 1996 or 1998 and put 2011 on them and just reissue them again. And most people think, well, that's quite a noble thing to aspire to do. So how different could things be? Well, at the moment it takes an average of 30 to 40 minutes to make a decision on benefits. That could actually be instant, using policy automation. And that's the type of space Universal Credits is trying to get into. Currently, we've got 40-minute phone calls that could potentially be done online or through a website for the majority of users. And in fact, the benefit of taking complexity and cost out for the majority of users should actually be the ability to enhance the services for the most socially disadvantaged and actually improve the quality of the services they receive. Currently, there's a one-hour face-to-face identity and circumstances check. And from what Patrick said, some of them are considerably longer than one-hour face-to-face processes that government currently has in place. If you crack the problem of identity properly and look at some of the ideas William and other people have, that could be largely automated. But at the moment, there's a face-to-face sign-on process, and again, why is that not automated as well? Why not take a lot of frictional cost and unnecessary inconvenience out of the system for people finding themselves disadvantaged? So from 2001, I thought this was a quite pertinent slide. E-government efforts won't succeed if all you do is put the current process online. Quite therefore, why a decade later that is precisely what has generally happened is a bit of a mystery to me. Again, Universal Credit, a wonderful opportunity to take lessons like this from a decade ago about thinking about how you redesign a system built around simplification and the end-user experience, not about the producer or the organisation responsible for administering the service. How might it look in the future? I guess when Universal Credits is live, we're be able to go online or receive on our mobile phone some sort of confirmation of payments being made to us. And perhaps government might choose, depending on its persuasion, that it wants to remind people there are no such thing as government-paid services, and actually your benefit comes from someone else in the UK. It'd actually be quite nice, I think, to aspire to catch up with places like Kenya and M-Pesa, so that mobile payments things could maybe be made directly to people's mobile phones. So maybe over the next decade, catching up with Kenya could be a sort of popular slogan. other useful things I think going on, people, slivers of time, for any of you've seen that. This is where people that can only do partial working, don't easily fit the sort of stereotype of are you in work or out of work. These are people that maybe have complex family lives, they're busy with children, they're carers as well, but they have some availability to do something they're good at. And people like Slivers of Time are looking at how you might build an online marketplace, a bit like an eBay of your services, if you like, where you just say, I'm available 2 hours a week in this area, I can provide this type of service. And just try and find more innovative ways of letting people re-engage in work in ways that currently just don't exist. So my sort of summary of how to make it happen, and I just concur with what a lot of other people said earlier today, is why don't we start by talking to the users of services instead of assuming that sitting in a nice Whitehall building that we've got a great understanding of actually what life is like at the front line for a lot of these people. And then design all of these services from the edge in. So universal credit, I would expect to be going out to the very edge, looking at the complexity as it currently exists, aiming to simplify that, aiming to work out how, if you're going to deliver that improved, simplified, painless process at the edge, that the central system that you build must have open APIs, must enable people to innovate. So if you go to a DWP or Job Centre Plus and have the type of, I think, the first experience that we saw on the video earlier, you can actually make meaning of the word customer, and you can take your custom elsewhere and maybe go to the Salvation Army or somebody else that might provide you with a better entry point to that particular government service than some people currently experience. I think there's a huge opportunity to adopt the sort of agile approach that's been used in for major private sector systems, and to look at things like what Prudential did with Egg and some of those serial entrepreneurs, where you've got a brownfield site that's got to keep existing systems going, but you want to do something new and innovative without detracting from those. And I think universal credit's an ideal opportunity to try that type of model. You want to keep the current tax and welfare systems completely uninterrupted while you bring forward what is actually a very innovative and radical approach. So why not incubate a new system that's semi-detached from that, that you can build and test iteratively, gradually bringing people online. Once you're happy it does what you wanted it to, you can then progressively switch off those older systems that are no longer needed. I think one of the other biggest things, as I look back, is this huge sort of fault line, if you like, between ministerial intent over the last 15 plus years and its execution and delivery on the ground. And I think the real test for sort of universal credit will not only be the obvious ones of, was it delivered on time to budget and does it actually work? It'll be, how flexible is it? The ministerial aspiration for universal credit is huge. And the test of it will be, for example, if, say, Scotland had more devolved powers over local benefits, that it would be very simply implemented on universal credit just by a change of a single line in the rule set, not by another 3 or 5 year work programme of change controls and complex reconfiguration. If there was a move towards local income tax, for example, given the close integration between real-time information at HMRC and universal credit, will these new systems dynamically and agile, you know, offer agile methods of changing systems? So when politicians of any persuasion want to move the lever of policy from one position to another, how agile are these systems going to be? So it's not just about, are they built to short, you know, to meet a short-term need, but are they actually going to fulfil that long-term political aspiration to provide flexible, agile IT at a policy-making level rather than just a technical level? And that's it for now.
And now we'll be hearing from Martin Ferguson, who is the Policy Director for Socrates.
Well, thank you, Jane, and thanks for staying to listen to this last session. I'm coming at this from a wild place, perhaps from the edge or somewhere near the edge of local public services. Socotim, as some of you know, Society of IT Management, 1,500 members, drawn from local government, police, fire, third sector, and suppliers to those sectors. And in a wild moment earlier this year, it was April the 1st, I put a blog on the Socotim website, why don't we develop a smartphone app to deliver universal credit? And it was half a joke, I suppose, and it was half serious, and I think reflects some of the points that have been made today. I'm reading a book at the moment, and hence my choice of the word wild, a book by Jay Griffiths. Her thesis is that our Western rational mindset tends to talk about wilderness as though it's a wasteland. And she goes into the Amazonian basin, she goes to the Inuit in northern Canada, Baffin Island, and so on. And she reflects on the fact that these indigenous people in these places actually have a very rich life. They live in harmony with their environment. They interact with those wild places. They have a totally different understanding than we do about what resources are, about what resourcefulness is, about what a good way of life is, perhaps, and indeed how they make sense of what we regard as the chaos in these places. And she uses this quote from Nietzsche, "You must have chaos in your soul to give birth to a dancing star." And it made me think about, you know, how do we make sense of the chaos out there in at the edge, if you like, to give birth to the dancing star of universal credit. And I guess for me, and talking to people in local public services, it is actually about things like people. It's about passion, emotion, and all those sorts of things that are difficult to kind of pin down, and less so about technology and all that goes with technology. And in fact, I was in a local authority yesterday where they have an improving the customer experience program. They have no budget for that program. They draw on those things I've just been talking about. They draw on people, passion, within the organisation and beyond the organisation, bringing those people together into a steering group, into a sounding board, into frontline staff groups, all focused on improving the customer experience and moving out and working with partners in the community and indeed volunteers in the community. I was talking earlier about their activities in the digital inclusion arena to have volunteers working in different public service access points to assist people with online access to public services. So there's a lot of things going on around the country that arguably Universal Credit could take advantage of if only they knew they were there. Now, just to structure what I'm going to be talking about over the next few minutes, I just want to focus for a moment on this document, Planting the Flag, a Strategy for ICT-Enabled Local Public Services Reform. It's a visionary document. It's something that sets out, and it does indeed plant a flag for what it says on the tin, if you like, local public services reform, and has been a local CIO council initiative. It's been endorsed by the current government CIO. Mark kindly gave us some words of support. And we're busy at the moment working with a whole range of partners to turn this from the rhetoric of a vision, if you like, to actual practical steps on the ground. And we recognise that this isn't a prescription of a single approach. It's going to be a whole variety of different approaches in different places reflecting the diversity of different localities. And we identify three core principles in that document for reform around collaboration, around redesign and innovation. And just quickly, collaboration, yeah, we talk about shared services, cooperation, but key to that is getting the governance right and getting a model of distributed leadership in place that can actually facilitate and enable those people who are passionate and emotionally involved in these things to move forward and to overcome some of the barriers that we heard about just a moment ago. Now, in terms of redesign, absolutely agree, yes, start with the user. Redesign service access, channel shift, all those sorts of things, inclusion I've touched on already. But also ways of working, so much more flexible and mobile working, the idea of anytime, anywhere, any device access. And then innovation, being transparent and open. We talk here about co-production with users, co-delivery of services, personalisation, and I think something that's been touched on earlier today, the democratisation of information and the democratisation of information systems that goes with that. So what I want to quickly cover then is a reflection on universal credit from these three points of view, and just to touch on some policy issues, delivery issues, and ICT issues in relation to each of those principles. A document that we produced a short while ago was an attempt to produce a service user's perspective on tomorrow's public services. And out of a number of different scenarios that we painted, we identified these range of principles. So self-service, multifaceted self-service. services redesigned as end-to-end processes, and reflecting on universal credit, I think that there is an issue at the moment that certainly from a local public services perspective, we see it as being designed within the confines of DWP. They've sent a questionnaire out to chief executives in local government. As far as I know, that's been the limit of local public services engagement in the design of universal credit. I may be wrong, but that's the perception. And yet, if you think about end-to-end processes for service users accessing universal credit, it isn't just about universal credit. It's about their whole lifestyle, the circumstances in which they find themselves, their work situation, their family situation, a whole variety of different things on which public services come to bear. And universal credit is just part of that. So if we're talking about an environment in which we're looking after people's well-being, then we take a totally different approach, I think, to the sorts of systems that we design and how those systems interrelate. So just going to touch then on a few points here in relation to collaboration on policy. Absolutely agree with Mark. You know, what are the outcomes that are being sought? You know, is it just efficient payment of universal credit, or is there a lot more to it in terms of the well-being of the service users that we are working with? Are there foreseen and unforeseen consequences and outcomes of what we're proposing? What's happening about housing costs and council tax? Ambiguity, and we're already seeing hemorrhaging of experienced, knowledgeable staff from local authorities as a consequence of that ambiguity. What is the role of the different stakeholders, including the third sector, local authorities, and so on? And has there been a risk assessment of what's being proposed currently? Is that transparently and openly available for scrutiny? On delivery, we've talked about dealing with people who have complex lives, perhaps chaotic lives, vulnerable people, but we need to be starting with them and the situations that they find themselves in and engaging with the people who deal with those situations. So benefits staff, we've heard from Citizens Advice, peripatetic nurses, both local government, third sector, hospices and so on, social workers, local government, again, third sector social workers, citizens themselves. So where are they in terms of the design of the delivery arrangements for universal credit? In terms of ICT, again, talking about and absolutely agree with Mark's point about needing to be business focused, and there are certainly pockets of good practice in local public services around the business-led public service outcomes, citizen-centred change approach. We need to be building on that and exploiting that in developing and implementing universal credit. But there is a question, and that is, what is the organisation? And I think what's coming out of today is that the organisation is much more than DWP, it's much more than HMRC, it's much more than local authority, it's much more than a third sector organisation. It's a whole combination of loosely bound together organisations. On redesign, is there flexibility in the policy approach? That point about, is it a bigger issue than just universal credit? And what methodology and mindset are we using? Is it agile? Is it a business value, as I say, etc., led approach? And we have a number of approaches that we use in local government quite widely and are freely available to the public services community. In terms of the delivery model, it appears at the moment to be focused on a highly centralised and monopolistic model for the delivery of universal credit, although I'm encouraged to hear people talking today about a much more open, competitive and distributed approach. On delivery, who's going to deliver the services? And again, encouraged, I think, by at least the exhortation that government is trying to develop systems that will act in a facilitating way to a range of delivery agents. So I think, as I say, that's an encouraging aspect of what we heard. But what we haven't heard about, and what doesn't seem to be in the melting pot at the moment, is thinking about that point that Mark ended on about transitioning delivery. You know, how do we do that in a way that is in a managed way and doesn't lose the expertise and knowledge, as I say, of staff working in local public services? What about performance monitoring? What are we actually monitoring against? What are we trying to achieve again? ICT, lots of issues around linkages. So if we think about identity management, which has been touched on, I think the view I've heard from DWP is that they're talking about a single system for all government services, so big tick, yeah, that's encouraging. We've heard that before, of course, and at the same time, tell us once, individual electoral registration, the list goes on. They're all talking about their own systems for identity management. So that's something that certainly we're hoping that at long last is going to be sorted as a consequence of universal credit. I'll just quickly skip down the list there to social media, something that's been touched on today, but huge scope, is there not, for bringing people together with different needs, to articulate those needs and to be able then to access appropriate systems. Mumsnet is perhaps an example of an environment that brings people together with common interests and common requirements in terms of systems and information. Okay, innovation in terms of policy. So key things for us here is that there seems to be a paradox between welfare reform and the whole localism agenda, they call it big society, but I mean essentially talking about empowering people, communities, citizens. Where does that sit in relation to this centralised model that I talked about for universal credit? In terms of delivery, the lack of transparency, I think. Where's the business case, the project plan, the deliverables, the benefits realisation, the performance management? I don't see it. Opportunities for co-production and co-delivery. So if we think about social care and health, citizens as data controllers, which William talked about, and linking that kind of approach to universal credit. ICT to enable personalisation. Where are suppliers in all of this? There's an existing community of suppliers that benefit systems to local government. I have to say, local governments, it's, 1988, when the first housing benefit legislation hit the statute books, it has been a successful story of implementation, of successive, quite major changes along the way. So where is that experience in terms of developing universal credit? Where are the developer communities? What about the seismic shifts in technology towards more mobile devices? So in terms of conclusions, absolutely welcome the approach in terms of open platforms, facilitating those best place to deliver. And there is a strong central drive to get this to work, and an agile approach being taken, but some reservations perhaps about how far that will go in terms of the business focus. So I suppose our invitation is to go to the wild places, to the organisations that act as advocates in those places, the professional bodies, local government association, local government group and so on, but more particularly the frontline staff, the citizens, the innovators, if you like, where the life is, where the people and passion are for improving the customer experience. And just to end on an even more wild note, that's where I'm going to be next week.
Thank you. Okay, well, not to put any pressure on you, but this is your last chance to ask questions for the day. So who would like to kick us off? We'll take two or three together and then feed them back. So, yeah, can we start? We'll start here.
Brian Wordham, National Audit Office. Mark, and the other panellists as well, but Mark in particular, if you were an external auditor, How would you go about checking the health of a major change program that claimed to be using Agile?
Okay, that's great, and we'll allow Mark a little time to think about that. Has anyone else got any questions they'd like to ask?
Go on.
Come on, it can't just be me. Come on, give us some questions.
Yeah. All right. Okay. Well, let's start with that while they think of some more.
Okay. Be a quick answer, so I haven't got much time to think of more questions. So how do you actually audit Agile? It's a very good question, and I don't have a short, snappy, succinct answer yet, it's fair to say. I think for me, the fundamental thing about it is that Agile is about delivery. And there's, I can't remember which state it is in the US. I think it might be Wisconsin. And the state motto is Show Me. And they're known as the Show Me State. And I think that, for me, is the fundamental difference between Agile and the kind of more waterfall approach, which is in Agile, you should be able to say at rapid points throughout the delivery arc, show me, and there's something real, something tangible, something concrete, which you can actually get your paws on, which you can actually use and do something with. That, for me, is the fundamental difference between auditing things. You know, it's like, at the moment, we kind of work on a basis that it's like asking a builder or an architect, you know, to build you a house, and then you go away. You come back 18 months later, however long it's taken, you look at it and you go, that's rubbish. You know, I mean, I didn't want a house like that. I want a completely different kind of house. You know, I think that for me is the fundamental difference. It's that immediate involvement.
Well, like you start off by building a shack or something, and says, "What do you think of that?"
Yeah.
After a few days, is it
well? Absolutely.
Brick involved.
Yeah, I think we need to be a bit careful, because otherwise we end up with a model which involves building the house a room at a time and kind of things. And if you do plan to do that, one piece of advice. Start with the rooms on the ground floor, not the rooms on the first floor. You'll find it much easier.
Did you have anything about performance management?
I think Agile should be easier to audit, because at any time you should be able to walk in and see a working system. And actually you can also pull the plug earlier, because it should be more apparent that it's already going off the rails. But part of that is also back to the user engagement, the whole point of using an Agile method. Is you have a prototype system running at all times of the project. Okay, it'd be pretty poor to begin with and gets richer as the project goes on. But that should also be being tested at all stages by frontline users, by citizens and other stuff. So if you go into a project that claims it's using Agile and they can't show you a working system and a bunch of users that can tell you whether it's meeting their needs, and I mean users not in terms of people building the system, but people that will actually end up as the sort of users of the system at the front line, so frontline workers and citizens. My concern is Agile's been slapped onto a lot of projects at the moment, and some people apparently have had 3 days training, so they're expert in the topic. The reality is, I suspect, that there's a lot of accelerated waterfall going on, and it should be easy to flush that out. And I'll go as far as say, if you walk in and start auditing what's meant to be an Agile project, and it doesn't have the features of Agile, that'd be a good reason to raise a red flag straight away and say this project is not doing what it claimed to be doing.
Can I just add that if someone's been on a 3-day course to learn Agile, they're not a developer, they are in fact a lead Agile consultant. Well worth £1,250 a day that you'll be paying for them.
Did you?
I think I'd just echo that point about, you know, let's get people involved. The Agile approach potentially is one that can deliver in stages in the way that Mark described, but my concern is, at the moment, it's not transparent to the people who ultimately may well be involved in helping to deliver universal credit. So let's open it up in a way that gets that engagement and enables those people to act as that check, if you like, on the performance of the system as it unfolds.
Yeah, I mean, just to wrap up very quickly, for reasons which still baffle me, the Wall Street Journal phoned up when Skunk Works was announced, and they asked what school of Agile we were going to use. My initial response was Drunken Monkey style, but what I said was, what school of Agile are we going to use? One that works.
Great. Have we got any more questions? Yeah.
I really enjoyed Jerry's talk, but I was suddenly a bit surprised when you mentioned Slivers of Time as a sort of great example. I mean, maybe I'm out of touch. My experience was that it sounded like a great idea. Then they started charging loads and loads of money. I'm just interested whether it had actually worked anymore. And the question about Agile is, how do you ensure that it's not just asking the business what they want, but you actually get some creative thinking into the approach?
Have we got any more before we... No.
What was that, the Slivers of Time?
Yeah.
Approach. Yeah, I guess it was less about... I'm not aware of what the commercial model was. It was just about thinking about more innovative ways of using technology to let people connect, rather than going to a job centre and looking on the kiosk and stuff. So there's an underlying bigger issue, I think, behind that question, which came up earlier about the role of intermediaries in the identity strategy and stuff, which has been tried before and failed because of the commercial model. Didn't work. Third-party ID providers wanted to charge £50 a year, which most people looked at and thought, why do I want to pay to have the pleasure of dealing with government online? I'll stick to paper, thanks very much. So I think there's some real issues of, can government, with some of these more ambitious programs, find the skills to actually foster the type of sustainable environment where third parties are incentivized to do that, whether that's for social reasons, so the Salvation Army or whoever, using some of these new systems at the edge to deliver services, or whether it's commercial providers that can find some viable model for making money out of it as well. And I think there are big issues that remain unanswered at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, and on the Agile point, you're absolutely right. I mean, it's back to, you know, Jerry's point about business process and just taking existing business processes and trying to put a plug on them. We need to be careful. There is an old programmer's saying, which I don't necessarily agree with, which says that the only people worse at designing systems than developers are users. But I think the nugget of truth in that saying is that we get conditioned by our current world, and we need to break out of that set of expectations, because otherwise we're not going to drive innovation, we're not going to drive opportunity. So you're absolutely right. You know, what we do need to do is not just support the business, but we also need and involve the business and engage with the business. We also need to challenge the business as well.
Okay. Is there any last question? Obviously, Patrick at the back there should have guessed.
Got to charge you for nicking his slides.
When I did my first sort of piece of work, the National Audit, which was back in 1998 to 99, we went to visit the benefits agency, which at the time had 68,000 staff, but only 8 had access to PCs that could communicate with the internet. We also went all over the Department of Social Security, as it was then, trying to find out who had built the website and why. And eventually, we wiped it on the crack. And we found these two guys in a place in Leeds, in Quarry Bank, who had more or less built the website on their own, with a lot of discouragement from their manager, who was a market research guy. And we said to them things like, well, why isn't there an address finder on, so you can find the address of your local DSS office on the site? And they said, well, we had put up a proposal that would cost £2,500. It was turned down because it was too costly. And this is from a department with, a budget of hundreds of millions of pounds a year. Now, last time I was in DWP doing NAO work was 2009, and at that time it was taking 2.5 years to process any system change that was going through. And, you know, it's a massive Byzantine IT bureaucracy, and there are all kinds of different factions inside it. Some of them are trying to preserve the integrity of systems, being spaced across the country, be nice to customers, and other people just want to administer things. And even when you go down to the grassroots, you find that people are not doing at the grassroots what the people at the top think they're doing. For example, we went to one center that was issuing pension credits, and half of the staff were making up the answers to feed to the customers. So they would say things like, "You haven't got your savings, have you?" Which people would say, "Oh," which was a taxpayer investment. 40% of the staff were filling things in on an old mainframe computer because it was a lot faster and they could get through the work a lot and so on. Now, I just would really like to know how Skunk Works is going to work in this kind of setting.
Right, okay, so it's only a little challenge then, which we have to deal with. I'd like to be able to say that I'm just going to snap my fingers and the world will be better, will be a better place. But I think for me, again, it comes back to, I think there are three things which give me kind of hope for the future in terms of how we might make a difference. The first one is that there are people inside the organisations who do want to make a difference, who do see that parts of the process are not necessarily as optimal as they could be, to use my careful language. And I'm passionate about making that difference. I think the second thing which gives me kind of some hope for the future is the fact that we can't carry on as we are. We don't have the money, we don't have the resources to do it. So we've got to do something different. You know, much as I hate that terrible consultant these expression, a burning platform. The platform's not so much burning as kind of, you know, burnt already, and we're kind of, you know, about to fall into the ocean. We've got no choice. We have to do something different. And I think the third thing which kind of gives me sort of hope for the future is that we have this weird situation, this weird setup, where the technology resources available to us outside of our working environment are so vastly superior to the resources we have inside our working environment. Because, you know, I'm pleased to say that those 8 internet available terminals, they've all been taken away, stopped staff from doing anything apart from focusing on their actual proper work. But the shift that causes, the push that causes of the outside world is huge. I mean, and for me, the most telling example is, you were talking about the local office environment. Friends of mine from the local office environment said to me that most people in local office didn't use the DWP guidance. They use guidance produced by people like Child Property Action Group, the rest of it, because they actually render down the animal into something you can kind of digest and use. Martin's point about social networking, when you combine that with it, you know, we've now got a world where, if you like, all agility, knowledge sharing, those tools are actually vastly richer outside our world. If we don't respond to that, then we're stuffed.
I guess only the other point about if you think about what trying to do at the edge, in a sense, is about delivering horizontal services, so ones that are tailored around the citizen. And obviously, Whitehall is still somewhat vertically siloed. And I do wonder, having watched this space and been involved in this space for the last 15 plus years, wonder whether you can actually deliver horizontal services at the edge if you've got vertical silos at the centre. And I do wonder whether the big thing Skunk Works may have to do is almost grow, and I refer to the sort of egg bank type model but almost you incubate some new organisations inside Whitehall that become the way things will be done in the future. And I think that has several advantages. One, you can rapidly prove and fail projects early, and you can experiment far more than you can within the confines of the existing large silo. And secondly, you can leave all the existing systems running untouched, existing systems and processes running. It's always a big fear to minister. You go with some bold new proposal about a new way of doing things, and then it's, we can't afford not to collect tax, we can't afford not to pay benefits, stop tinkering, stop playing with things. So, absolutely, leave them how they are, and then try and incubate these new things. And the ones that are successful and begin to fly, they become the future world, built around the citizen demand, and over time you can then atrophy and turn off those existing back-end systems. But that's not a technology issue. That's a huge change to the governance and culture of Whitehall. If that were going to happen, you're effectively talking about cabinet office portfolios that are focused on outcomes and citizen experiences and not about backward-looking current vertical silos of arbitrary functions at the centre. So the question is whether the political will is there to drive through that level of cultural change that would enable technology to deliver what we all know it's latently possible of doing, but which after all this time it still really hasn't done.
Yeah, I think from a local public services perspective, that sort of approach that Jerry's advocating would address many of the frustrations of the frontline worker, those people who are passionate about doing a good job for the citizen to address the outcomes that they're concerned about. My concern, I think, like Jerry's, is that, you know, does government actually get it? The signal at the moment is their whole focus in terms of information and systems is on central government information and systems within the silos. It is not about that horizontal approach to service delivery at the front line, at the local level.
Okay, we've got time for one last question. I think there's a gentleman at the back there.
Hi there. The question for the gentleman from Skunk Works, but also related to what the gentleman from Microsoft was saying. So the Microsoft angle is, yes, you should build something new, which is horizontal, which is cross-government, and which doesn't, you know, rely on the existing silos and you know, the old ways of working, because then you can move to, you know, a brave new world. But is that not perhaps a way of marginalising something which is new and saying, you know, okay, you can be over there, you can do your new thing, but, you know, the grown-ups will continue running the real systems in the silos which do the real work? And then to the gentleman from Skunk Works, how are you going to avoid being, you know, kind of cast as the interesting new but not really serious thing?
Yeah, that's a very good point. When we were setting up the Skunk Works, we spent a lot of time talking to people who'd run similar kind of initiatives across the piece, both in other parts of the public sector, but also in the private sector. And the fundamental thing which they said to us was, you need to be careful, because otherwise what happens is you become a novelty, but you don't actually change the business model. So I think there are a couple of things which we are keen to do to try and avoid that. So the first one is, and I think Jerry's absolutely right, is that there are times when the kind of egg or first direct model is the model you have to take, because you've got something which is technologically possible. There is a business drive to do it, but organisational culture simply does not allow you to do it. So you have to find a different way of doing it to make it happen. And then the challenge is, how do you do it in such a way that you actually bring it with you? But I think the second thing which we're looking at doing is to say, well, actually, there are a lot of islands of good practice. There are a lot of people there who actually want to make a difference, who actually want to drive things differently. How can we connect these people? How can we build, if you like, that community which allows people to break out of the silos themselves and give them the tools and the support to actually make that happen and help them to challenge existing business models? That's something else which we're looking at doing. Now, none of these things are necessarily going to make me the world's most popular person. But as I say, you know, previously, we've got no choice. You know, we can't sustain the existing world. And so we do need to find a way of making innovation not something which sits outside and is seen as something which is kind of over there and it does these amazing things, but it doesn't really have any connection with the real world. We actually need to make that part of our business process. And we do need to, you know, and I think Jerry has raised a really interesting challenge, and I don't know what the answer to it is either, but it's a really interesting challenge about, do we look to fundamentally reshape how we deliver services to take advantage of what technology allows us to do, which I would phrase perhaps even more simply, which is, do we actually, in the public sector, look to make use of IT as a source of, as a way to drive business value? And I think that's a difficult question. I don't have a simple answer to it. And I probably haven't answered your question at all, because to be frank, I don't really have a good answer at the moment. I mean, one of the things about the Skunk Works, and that's part of the reason why the Skunk Works is going to be a very open organisation, very fluid boundaries, is that we don't have answers to a lot of these questions at the moment, and we need to work with people like yourselves to actually test those answers, test the problems, and see can we come up with solutions to some of these problems, because we have to be honest.
I would have thought digital by default would mean precisely that. But actually, as you design new public services like universal credit, they are designed to be digital by default, and then you plug in additional channels as required. Which does raise questions in my mind, because only about 3 government departments have CIOs on their board. So I do wonder, as they're planning public services, who on those boards is currently providing the expertise and insight into how those services are going to be designed to be digital by default and not have IT thrown at them further down the process. And in terms of whether if you adopted the sort of vague or direct line model that the existing vertical silos would just sort of almost isolate it and leave it off on the side as some sort of limp attachment. Again, that comes back to the political will. If the politicians say, at the end of this process, that new entity is the way the welfare system in the UK is going to be working, that would become the reality. And again, I think there's a lot of frustration across all the parties that I talk to, that there are 15 years of promises that IT will enable better quality, cheaper public services haven't happened. And there's an increasing desire to break through that sort of fault line and actually make it stick this time. Because otherwise, if you're not getting a benefit, you might as well save the $16 billion a year that's spent on IT and just plough it directly back into yet more manual services, if it's really not delivering a benefit that you can prove.
Yeah, just a final point. Let's get out into the wilderness. Let's actually meet the people who are going to be using these services and the people who are going to be delivering them.
Great. Well, thank you so much, all of you, for coming, and all of our speakers from today. We're going to be writing up some notes about this, and also the presentations from the speakers and the podcast from today will be available online, and we'll send that around to you to let you know so that you can go back to sessions that you particularly enjoyed or circulate to colleagues. I think we've heard about some problems, actually, that have been around for a number of years now. We've been talking about how government needs to join up. We've been talking about how government needs to open up to new types of providers or work better with different types of providers. We've heard about the same problems around identity management and a lack of user voice. But I think we've also heard sort of opportunities and the moves in general society towards greater use of technology, that this does present some opportunities. I mean, I think the work that we're doing is looking at not just digital by default, but actually inherently digital public services and how that might work over this next period. So thank you very much. If you will, again, help me thank